Good afternoon, my name is John Glenn. I'm the Member of Parliament for Salisbury, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you here for this Henry Jackson Society discussion on the rise of the Islamic State and the implications for UK security. So if you were here for the Northern Iraq session before, then there may be some overlaps of interest. But we have three excellent speakers who will speak for 5 to 7 minutes, and then we will have a discussion. We must finish promptly at 2 o'clock. Our first speaker is James Bloodworth. He's the editor of Left Foot Forward, previously written in many of the mainstream media in the UK, as well as other publications. Charlie Cooper is the programmes officer at Quilliam. He researches militant Islamist movements and most recently focused on the rise of the Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's Islamic State, exploring in particular its ideological clashes with al-Qaeda. And our final speaker is Robin Simcox. He's a research fellow at the Henry Jackson Society. I'm sure is known to many of you as a prolific commentator on this and other subjects. If we could start with James. Are you ready, James?
Yes.
Great. Thank you. 5 to 7 minutes. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I know both my fellow speakers are going to be talking about some interesting aspects of the growth of ISIS today, and I wanted to take a slightly different focus. So looking at not just the ISIS, but on the history of kind of absolutist totalitarian movements such as fascism and communism and Islamism, and what I think they can tell us about the motivation of ISIS we're seeing now. Obviously there are multiple factors that motivate people to join a movement like ISIS, and I'm sure other panellists are going to talk a bit about that today. So for example, there's a sense of alienation that some Muslims feel from British society due to things like racism. There's sunny alienation from the government apparatus in Iraq. There's rebellion against Bashar al-Assad in Syria. There's also, in some instances, resentment about global injustice that leads people to this very dark path. I wanted, though, to talk about the power of ideas, or more specifically, the power of ideas in and of themselves. And what I mean by this is that I want to talk about how certain outcomes are no more than the result of people having certain thoughts in their heads and as a consequence performing certain actions. This isn't to say that ideas don't have grounding in the material world, but rather it's to argue that a liberal and open society isn't universally attractive. And it hasn't ever been, if you look at recent movements, absolutist and totalitarian movements. So, for example, we in this room probably accept a high degree of freedom as a given, whether we're social democrats, liberals or conservatives. Believe it or not, though, there are in every society in the world movements of varying degrees of strength who don't think like that, and you think quite differently. The conclusion you should perhaps draw from this is actually quite a depressing one. It's that anti-liberal movements are inclined to pop their heads above the parapet from time to time in every society. So in an Orwellian twist, there really is a war without end to some degree. It should be obvious why. There's no end of history, there's no nirvana, there's no utopia. Life is a constant struggle. For a free and open society, and it's a struggle against the forces that would otherwise close those societies down. The reason that the ideas develop in opposition to those open societies are numerous, and the reason that they're often so difficult to combat is that they can often be no more than the expression of the temperament of the individual who's holding such ideas. Freedom breeds anxiety, as I'm sure you're all aware. And to accept a free society, you have to accept anxiety as part of the price. And not everyone can do that. So, for example, freedom means that some people do better than others. I'm a social democrat, so I believe in reducing the gap between rich and poor. But at the same time, I accept the central objection to a completely egalitarian system. But not everyone does. Some people are willing to use force to bring about a fully egalitarian society because they don't accept the freedom of some people to do slightly or greatly better than others. Give me 1 second. Similarly, you've probably noticed that extremist movements, when they involve an element of religion, they don't particularly like the dating game. Or to be more specific, they don't like the fact that in Western society, women have almost as much sexual freedom as men, and therefore just as much choice as severe as they have relations with. So to quote an ex-communist that appears in one of Arthur Koestler's novels, when religious movements start preaching extreme sexual morality at women, what they're often doing is trying to overthrow a society in which nobody has asked them to dance. This side of it all looks a lot more like male insecurity on steroids. So in sum, some people join ISIS for a similar reason that people have in the past joined communist and fascist movements and other absolutist movements. They reject the sort of freedom with all its imperfections, all its anxiety, all its competition that we take for granted. And I think, as I've mentioned, temperament is an underplayed element of this, probably because it's very hard to know exactly what we do to inoculate against it. So ISIS and violent Islamism more generally are, as I said, the latest in a long line of anti-liberal doctrines and movements that reject the open society. Because ISIS, its doctrines like communism and fascism, because it carries absolute status, it's no longer simply a guide to action, but an abstraction that must be imposed on reality by force, and regardless of the human cost. I think this also highlights a mistake that people commonly make when they hear, when they heap opprobrium on, when they blame Islam as a uniquely malevolent religion. Certainly Islamism, I'd say, has roots in Islam, but then so did communism have its roots in European social democracy. Strands of fascism had their roots in right-wing Catholicism. The point is that almost all ideologies, when taken as absolutes, invariably cause huge damage to societies. To bring up Arthur Koestler again, who I've already mentioned, he once said that the difference between a person of liberal and absolutist temperament was that the absolutists viewed wrong ideas as crimes committed against future generations. I think this is an absolutely crucial point. It's why, for example, someone like Che Guevara in the 60s was prepared to fire nuclear weapons at Miami in a first strike, because the rationale, if you can call it that, was that in the long run, you would ultimately save lives if there was no more United States of America. In the utopian mind, wrong ideas have to be punished in a similar way that we punish other crimes. Even a much esteemed Bertrand Russell is quoted as accepting that if it could be demonstrated that humanity would live happily ever after if the Jews were exterminated, there would be no good reason not to proceed. The Aztec believed they could rip the hearts out of thousands of people so the sun wouldn't go out. The means, any means, become acceptable when you throw your lot in with utopia, whether that's the classless society, paradise, and yes, a caliphate. When these ideas bump up against reality, as they inevitably do, the people espousing them don't tend to drop the ideas, but instead they tend to, murder a large proportion of the people they're running their experiments on. After all, if you believe you're creating heaven on earth, then anything that stands in your way can be crushed under your foot like a rotten apple. In the case of ISIS, this involves, as we've seen, the taking of women and girls as slaves, murdering people who convert to Islam, and murdering insufficiently Islamic minorities. Just before I wrap up, I think part of the reason the revolutionary despotic ideas are so have a tendency to attract young men and teenagers is that there's something very infantile about the whole that says "if I were king." It's the anti-Stalinist historian Robert Conquest, again someone I think is really worth studying on the topic of totalitarianism, defines it as a belief that it only needs well-intentioned people in power to solve everything by mere decree. So on that note, a 19th century French novelist once described the excesses of the French Revolution, as nothing but the anger of a disappointed child. Even Leon Trotsky, himself something of an absolutist, recognised the sheerly psychopathic element that underpins fascism, writing in the 30s that 100 million people use electricity but still believe in the magic power of signs and exorcisms. And in Syria today, and Iraq, alongside the 21st century exists the 7th century. To look for the root cause of ISIS, as I've written before, is kind of to miss the point. There's certainly plenty of reasons for the group's growth, and there are also concrete things that can be done to persuade young people thinking of fighting for ISIS that is the wrong path for them to take. But why then we should get away from the idea that groups like ISIS and totalitarian groups in general will simply go away if only the West plays nice? It's perfectly possible for Western governments and organisations to formulate policy that minimises the impact and effectiveness of ISIS, of a group like ISIS. The mistake, is, however, is to assume that one day we'll no longer have to worry about the absolutist mentality. ISIS represents, to my mind, all the barbarism that every now and then is inclined to crawl out from the depths of the human subconscious, just as European fashion wants to do the same. If there's anything possibly good that can come out of ISIS and jihadism, it should be a reminder that of exactly why democracy, pluralism, and women's and LGBT rights are so valuable, and that they didn't drop out of the sky and they were fought for, and that they also need to be constantly defended. Thank you very much.
Charlie, thank you very much, James. Charlie.
Thank you, James. So, I'm going to talk more about Islamic State from a recruitment point of view. And then I'm going to look at what we can do to reduce the threat that people returning from Iraq and Syria, as many have done, reduce the threat that they could and do present to the United Kingdom. First, I'm going to talk about what appeal they have. I mean, why is a group that beheads people, summarily executes people in their hundreds, and talks about massacring people, boasts about massacring people, what appeal does this have? The thing is, in Iraq and Syria, we've witnessed over the last 5, 10 years, 20 years, instability, totalitarian, non-Islamist ideologies, which have really torn apart the material that these countries are made of. The Sunni majority in northwestern Iraq has seen the Maliki government systematically marginalise it from the politicking of Iraq over the last few years, which has meant that it's very disgruntled. There's going to be no sahwa like there was in the late 2000s that kicked al-Qaeda in Iraq out of power. What we need to do is realise that it's a political solution and a political problem that we're dealing with here, and that's where the appeal lies for Islamic State in the local region. It's the fact that what people are living under now in places like Mosul and Raqqa is actually preferable to what there was before, which is quite a shocking thing, but we need to recognise that. Now, foreign fighters, there are lots of them. There are, I think, 12,000 was the latest authoritative estimate, 3,000 from Europe, in total from 81 states across the world. So it's a significant phenomenon, and much bigger than any former conflict before. And that's a very striking and important fact. What seems to confuse people is that there are people who grow up in the UK in a Western liberal democracy. And they have a life of luxury. They're not uneducated, but they still see an appeal, an attraction to Islamic State. And what this is the utopian aspect of the group, which we haven't seen with a group like al-Qaeda. Islamic State has declared that it's established a caliphate, an Islamist caliphate. It's not an Islamic caliphate. Nothing about Islamic State is Islamic. And the fact that they have established this caliphate is a huge draw for disaffected youth living in the West. They see, unlike people who are living in Iraq and Syria, who see it as an alternative, a preferable alternative, people in the West see going to fight for Islamic State as fulfilling their destiny and ushering on the end times. They want to go because they see it as a utopia, true Islam, and that idea permeates within all Islamic State propaganda. And on the propaganda, which, I mean, you'll all have heard about, it's very, very effective and of a very high production value. And this is, again, something which defines it against a group like al-Qaeda. I mean, last week, Zawahiri, the current leader of al-Qaeda, released a tape announcing the establishment of al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent. And it was, to be quite frank, boring. We don't have this with Islamic State's propaganda. They show strategic victory after strategic victory, many military exploits. It's really deeply affecting the stuff that they produce and popularise over Twitter. And the question that everyone wants to answer right now is, what do we do with the people who come back from Iraq and Syria? Because the fact of the matter is, even if we don't want them to come back, they will. And what we'll have is broadly two different kinds of people coming back. The first are those who have been brutalised by the conflict, disillusioned, realised that fighting jihad against other Muslim, Islamist factions in Syria is not what they went out to fight. They want to fight Assad, but they end up killing Muslims, and that's not what they want. These people are very important. We need to focus on taking them within, we need to bring them into the country, and we need to de-radicalize them. They can't come back with impunity, because they have been fighting with a terrorist organization, an implicitly terrorist organization. But what we have within this section of people is a resource for future conflicts, because this conflict isn't going to go away. These people have been brutalized and disillusioned by the fight for Islamic State are those people that will be most effective in de-radicalizing people in the future. And that's a difficult fact to swallow, because many people just view them as a blanket threat. Why would we bring them back into the country if they chose to leave? But since this problem is a long-term problem, it's going to be around for decades, we need to activate this resource. We need to bring these people in and talk to them. We need to figure out what's going through their minds and then use them in the future to help de-radicalize others and stop others from going out. Now, that's the first type. The second type of person who will be coming back here hasn't, it seems, come back yet. And it's, I don't want to be alarmist about this, but there will be people fighting for Islamic State who completely are committed to their extremist fascist ideology and completely reject any Western liberal values that we have. And it's this type of person that we need to be concerned about. And it's this type of person that the security services need to be very, very careful in detecting. And it's, again, another reason to bring other people, other disillusioned jihadists, back into the fold. Because these are the people that will be able to identify the other side, the people who don't want to be noticed, and the people that do have malicious intentions if they return to the UK. And it's imperative that we tap into this resource and recognise it as a resource. But we need to be cautious with it. I think it's short-sighted to think that we should take away people's passports while they're there, because that will not solve the issue. Equally, blanketly saying that there will be long prison sentences for anyone returning, that is a deterrent to people who are disillusioned coming back. And I'll leave it with this. We can't, as you'll have all seen on Friday, the Sunday Times reported that, the Times reported that 30, upwards of 30 foreign fighters were disillusioned and wanted to come back, but they were deterred by the fact that there were long prison sentences waiting for them. We can't have simple illiberal measures to punish these guys when they come back. I can't emphasize this enough. We need to be able to bring them back, and we need to be able to talk to them, and they need to feel like they can be brought back into their rights as a British citizen, and it's imperative that we tap this resource. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Charlie. If any of you are like me, you're probably having lots of questions being provoked in reaction to somebody's statement, which is how we want it. So we look forward to getting onto that stage in a moment. I'll now invite our last speaker, Robin Simcox, to address us. Robin.
Thank you. Thank you for coming today. Amazing, really, this event is taking place. For someone who worked on Iraq quite a lot in this period leading up to the rise of the Islamic State, and anyone else who did knows what a dead subject it was, how much the world had moved on past this conflict, how little interest there was on it, and I think a big part of this was that President Obama had said that this dumb war that he inherited and that he campaigned against in 2008, and he said he'd end responsibly in 2012, that it was that the Iraq struggle was over. It most certainly wasn't. The removal of US troop withdrawal in 2011 removed a key check on the Iraqi political system. The honest broker that the Americans were in that system, their removal allowed Maliki to indulge his worst sectarian instincts, created this groundswell of Sunni resentment that was festering already, but certainly exacerbated by Maliki. Contributing to this amazing rise, really, of ISIS, a group that is sometimes associated as only growing in power because of what was happening in Syria. Now, what happened in Syria energized the group further, but it was already a growing threat even before the problems we were facing there. And now is obviously a threat to the extent that that we have President Obama carrying out bombing raids in Iraq and. It looks like now advancing into Syria. An amazing turnaround, something that was virtually unimaginable 12 months ago that President Obama would want to bomb ISIS and Iraq and Syria, a group that you have to remember, not so long ago he was referring to as a junior varsity team, a JV team, basically trying to make out that they were a group that was only interested in local squabbles and wouldn't be of any real threat to the region or the West. I have some concerns, even though, I mean, I think there's no doubt, absolutely no doubt, the ISIS need to be stopped, and we may have different views on how to achieve that. I think that the military component is going to be vital, but I do have concerns about some of the things that are taking place and what could take place in Syria and Iraq. The intelligence on the ground, for example, in both seems to me to be one of the challenges. One of the negative consequences of the American engagement or lack of engagement in Syria in recent years, it strikes to me, is the fact that now I think we will be struggling to find partners we can work with that are going to provide us the kind of intelligence we need to effectively target ISIS in Syria. We also have to very much balance what we're doing in Syria with the need to... We all want to weaken ISIS, I don't think there's any doubt about that, but we can't do it to the... One of the consequences can't be strengthening Assad. It can't be working with Assad. This is someone who's completely lost any right to be part of the conversation on this. We have to make sure we, as best we can, don't strengthen other extremist groups operating in Syria, the al-Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda affiliate who ISIS are competing with, or other actors that stand to benefit from ISIS being weakened. Vetting the correct Syrians in terms of arming and training, it strikes me again, it's going to be a lot more difficult now than it would have been 3 or so years ago. Iraq, the problems are different to an extent. We obviously did have that network in Iraq. There was a lot of the tribal groups that the US was working with to defeat al-Qaeda in the first place in the 2006-07 period. But when we left Iraq militarily, when we left Iraq politically in 2011, so many of those contacts went up in smoke. There was a lack of American interest in keeping them, and I think it's going to be really, really difficult for us to go back in now and just pick up where we left off. It's going to be there's a big trust deficit here that we need to begin to fill again. How that impacts our ability to effectively attack ISIS in Iraq, I think, is the key worry here. Obviously, the political side of what's happening in Iraq is also extremely important. Maliki has gone, which is obviously a good thing. But the formation of the Iraqi cabinet this week, it's been praised, welcomed cautiously, but I think we should make sure that we keep a pragmatic eye on this, because it's been cautioned by America and Iran. Now, America and Iran have very different goals in Iraq, and they have very different priorities, very different perceptions of what makes a good government. So, at the moment, it seems to me the composition of it is still basically Shia Islamist groups and Shia Islamist stakeholders, which isn't a great surprise. There have been some welcome additions to talk about army, reform of the army, but I think we do need to make sure we keep being engaged in the politics to make sure these changes do take place. This is something that we were really negligent on, I think, especially in the 2010 onwards period. The other thing I think is interesting to look out from President Obama's speech last night is he's still talking about this in terms of a counter-terrorist operation. I mean, the US is at war with al-Qaeda and its affiliates, but in terms of Iraq, he feels that he doesn't feel comfortable talking about this as a war. He references American operations in Yemen and Somalia as a precedent, which has got to be the first time. I mean, I'm not sure too many people in Baghdad want it to be more like Mogadishu. I'm not sure too many people in Anbar want it to be too much like Hadramaut in southern Yemen. I mean, it's an odd precedent for President Obama to use, and one not without its complications. So to wrap up on how this affects UK security, returning fighters certainly is going to be a problem. We saw in the Jewish Museum in Brussels in May 2014, Mehdi Nemmouche, a returning ISIS fighter, carrying out an attack there, killing 4 people. Some of these attacks may not be directed necessarily by ISIS, but by fighters who have trained with them and been inspired by the group. Charlie's gone through some of the different options we have in terms of dealing with this. I think that prosecution does have to be an element. I think it has to be, potentially, if people have committed crimes, it would strike me as an odd precedent to set, to say that we're going to put those crimes aside. I mean, we didn't prosecute anyone on the back of Bosnia or Iraq or Afghanistan or Kashmir, and things haven't turned out great as a result. So I do think we need to keep that option open, as well as surveillance and channel and de-radicalisation, all the other things that can go into the mix to mitigating this threat successfully. So Iraq and Britain obviously faced very different challenges as a manifestation of the rise of ISIS, but it is underlined by the same basic ideological struggle. And it's an ideological struggle that's not going anywhere. It's one that I would warn is going to be generational. I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank our three speakers for sticking to time. We've now got just under half an hour, and I think we will operate under the Chatham House rule, so you can mention what's said but not attribute it.